Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor here with my co-host, Alex Shiflett. How are you doing, Alex?
I'm doing great. How about yourself, Lee?
So far, so good. First show of the day.
Yes.
You nervous?
No, I'm excited.
I'm a little nervous.
Don't be nervous.
How was your weekend? Did you do anything fun?
Great. I enjoyed that day yesterday, the sunshine.
I know.
Took my dogs for a long walk.
I'll tell you, in the morning it was like 30 something. And then the afternoon, I went to the gym and there were people laying out by the pool.
Yeah.
It was crazy. Well, I'm excited about today's show. We got an old friend, Linda Brenner from Designs on Talent. She's here. And then a little later, we'll have Casey Smith with Wiser Wealth Management. So let's kick it off with Linda. How you doing, Linda?
I'm very good. Thank you.
Now, for the one or two people out there who don't know about Designs on Talent, can you share a little bit about what you're up to?
Yes, we have grown a lot this year. We are laser focused on helping organizations get better at hiring.
At hiring? You think that's a problem?
I think I contend that's a problem.
So what is the problem with people in their hiring?
Well, organizations are notoriously frustrated with the efforts to find people when they need them and with the skills they need.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of reasons for that.
Now, is that, okay, let's walk through the process. So you typically work with larger firms?
Typically, right? About 80% of our clients are Fortune 500.
Okay, so now what are their challenges? What are they calling you for?
I'm going to pretend I'm on a sales call right now.
Okay, and I'll pretend that I'm who?
Nobody. I'll do both
parts.
So
you're going to do both parts? It'll make my life easier.
I am the head of HR, or I'm a senior business leader.
Okay.
I am so frustrated. We have all these recruiters. I don't know what they're doing. We can't fill jobs. The candidates that they bring in, we don't like. They're not qualified. They're not prepared. It's killing us. We're losing business.
Okay. So I'm going to pause you there because I have a question as a layperson. Big companies have multiple recruiters. So they've outsourced this to multiple people. This challenge,
well, usually,
or do they have like a go-to?
That's a good question. Usually the recruiters are employees of the company.
Okay, so they're
they might have 100 employees. If I'm AT&T, I have 400 employees all over the world.
That are looking for talent.
Constantly looking to fill jobs.
Mm-hmm. And then these are jobs at all levels. So some of them might be college graduates and some of them might be senior people.
Could be hourly employees, call center employees, retail, restaurant, managers, designers, strategists, executives, everything.
Now, isn't that difficult for that recruiter to be kind of an expert to know who's good in each of those skills?
Wow, you've honed in on one actual problem we see all the time, which is sometimes recruiters are just given just whatever jobs come in. So I could be working, along that entire spectrum, which is, does idiotic sound bad? That's a really bad approach.
It doesn't make any sense.
No,
so like
makes
one
no
minute
sense.
You're like, I got to find a call center guy. And then next person, I need a senior accountant.
No. Typically, they're organized by job type. So if I'm a call center recruiter, I'm usually.
You're a specialist.
Usually.
Somewhat.
Yeah.
So now where do you come into play?
So what we do is we take a very engineering approach to figuring out what is happening. And people think recruiting is pretty stupid and easy. So
you know what? Why do you?
No,
you've used the word idiotic and stupid.
I will not use either one of those anymore. I'll use numbskull next.
Okay,
No. Leaders often think there's people unemployed. How hard can this be?
Right.
Go find someone.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have the time or interest in understanding the mechanics behind it. But it's actually a beast of people, process, technology. You have social media. You have your applicant tracking systems. You have vendors. You have compliance. You have the worst thing about it is everybody's a stakeholder. So every hiring manager has an opinion. Every senior leader wants to see reports. Everyone internally is potentially a candidate that wants a different job. So you've really got to please a lot of stakeholders who mostly have completely wildly unrealistic expectations.
And since you're dealing with human beings as kind of the product in this case, right? Because you're hiring a human being to fit in this.
Yep.
It isn't only can they do the skill. They have to also be kind of a culture fit in the organization, right? So that adds another layer of complexity to this.
Yep.
And it's not like, I want white sheets of paper and, I can tolerate kind of a little variance in this.
Mm-hmm.
If the person meets all the skill requirements and then is a jerk,
Right.
It doesn't matter, right?
That right, it doesn't matter. And someone that does well in a R&D group at a pharmaceutical company who's a rock star there
right.
might actually fail in a different pharmaceutical company because right. the culture is so different. So that is another thing that's
so not. This isn't just science. There's some art to this as well.
There is definitely art to choosing who's a good fit for the job. There's an art to me. If I called you today and tried to convince you to come do my radio show, I mean,
I don't know if you're that good.
I probably could get you to take a job that doesn't exist, but I'm just saying it would be tough. I have to have a lot of confidence and credibility and understanding about right. my business. So,
all right. So now walk me through your day.
My day?
Right. Like somebody calls you. Now what happens?
Well, I think the one thing that's really different about us is two things. One is not many people work in this area. Companies that say they help companies fix their staffing problems are usually selling staffing services. They're usually a temp agency or an outsourcing firm that you can outsource recruiting to. We don't do any of that. So we are process design experts in talent acquisition. So that's one thing that's different. We are using your existing resources and evaluating using an audit, kind of an internal audit approach to understand what's good that you're doing, what can you leverage, what needs to be fixed, what other approaches and strategies can you think about. The other thing is we tie talent to the bottom line for businesses. We make connections to help them understand what jobs are way more important than others and that merit over investing in finding and keeping these employees, which is pretty countercultural for HR types sometimes.
And then, so you're looking at kind of a holistic view of the company, not necessarily find me Bob.
Correct. Yeah. We'll come in and we'll often meet with the senior leaders. If it's a public company, we can get a lot of financial data to understand where are you placing your bets? How is this business going to grow? If they say, if it's this radio show and we're going to grow to 15 cities, well, what are the most important roles that are needed to grow? Is it sales? Is it technicians? I have no idea. If it's Raytheon, it's engineers. If it's Home Depot, it's merchants. If it's Coca-Cola, it's brand managers. If we end up treating those jobs, the merchants at Home Depot, in the exact same way as we treat accounts payable clerks or trainers or marketing coordinators, we are not going to do a great job on any of those. We have to overinvest in finding and filling and keeping those merchants at Home Depot, or that company can go off the rails.
Now, when you're working like that, are you going to, like, you keep using Home Depot, but you go to Home Depot and then you kind of have a profile of what the perfect merchandiser is, and then you're going out and looking for more of that type of person?
Yes, but the first step will be, what is driving the greatest value in that company? So it would be an exercise to determine it is, in fact, the merchants.
Right.
Maybe it is, maybe it isn't.
Right.
So
how
we
do that?
We get senior leaders together. We reflect back to them, if it's a publicly held company, what they're telling to investors, what they're sharing with shareholders. And we facilitate conversations where what's most important here? What's it going to take? It usually does come down to a debate between it's sales or product. But ultimately, product wins, because the sales guys can sell, but they can't sell anything if there's no product. So these guys designing products, if that's the business, that's a debate they have to agree to. So finding those product guys, we have to put a lot more money and effort into that.
Now, sometimes when you go in and have this kind of a conversation, because like you said, it is a little contrary.
Countercultural.
Countercultural to what they've historically done.
Yes.
So don't they think they know? And then when you come in and you're like, well, maybe you don't know and we should kind of explore this a little bit, and you might land on something that isn't what they thought.
Absolutely. That's why it's really facilitated discussion about where are you placing your bets? How are you expecting this business to grow?
And they're open to this conversation?
Oh, they're desperate for it because it's not working well right now. There's zero unemployment in some of these key jobs.
Right.
IT, strategy,
right.
whatever.
It's probably
so
negative.
Yeah, exactly. There are people probably having working two jobs. So to go out and get them, you have to have a really well thought out process with great technology and skilled recruiters. And people don't even know where to begin. And what recruiting functions typically do that will be the death knell for them is they treat all their open jobs, like I come into work and I have 40 new jobs I got to fill, whatever. The function treats the jobs like milk. It's kind of first in, first out. Or if you yell at me, then I'll fill
right,
your
then
jobs.
I go higher, right?
The yeah. More, but
how many emails do I have from Lee?
Yes, okay, exactly.
I guess we better work on his thing.
But either way is a really stupid approach to filling jobs. And we have to have an ability to prioritize it by what's adding the greatest right. value to the business.
And so I'm sure the executives like that, prioritizing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Right? That makes sense to them. Now, what is the thing that they give you the most pushback on? Because it sounds good. You had me at hello.
Well, that's good. It is. Here's one thing that they really, really hate hearing. It is going to be a 3-year process. It really is. It's.
You is it to change the mindset of the recruiters? Like, what's the hard part of this?
The recruiters, the hiring managers, your technology is usually not optimized. The process doesn't exist to prioritize and to invest more heavily in certain jobs. So the whole process has to be redesigned. Usually the org structure changes because of that. We have...
And people like change like
they
this.
They so love change. Just, they love it when we do it. Right. No, not really. But yeah, they're 3 years. It's like, you know, took you how many years to get here? So...
But what's the pain they're having that they think I better call Linda?
They cannot fill their business is actually unable to grow because they can't fill jobs. We had a head of HR call us from a Canadian mid-cap technology firm that we had never heard of. They turned out to be a fantastic company. And her thing is, we've decided to open an office in Detroit. And I said, why would you open an office in Detroit? She said, well, because we can't fill these jobs here in Canada. And we know that Americans relocate more frequently. No, they don't. Americans are way more less interested in relocating. So, but we talked a little bit more.
But where did they get that information?
I have no idea. But they were on this train to open up other offices where actually in a market that would have been disastrous for them. So we ended up working with their senior team to really analyze what kinds of jobs do you need to fill. And we facilitated several discussions with them to identify 4 roles. Then we analyzed within 100-mile radius, where do these roles exist? And we found tons of them.
In Canada.
In that area. But they just weren't that honed in on what do they really need. And now they have to have really good recruiters to pick up the phone and call someone that's not looking for a job and say, let me tell you about a job that's going to blow your mind.
So now when you're working with a firm, you're working at the highest level of the organization because you have to have the buy-in from them because this is so strategic,
correct?
Right? Yeah. So then are you then going down to the recruiter level to give them kind of tactical skills in order to execute on this? Yeah. So you're working... Kind of
and hiring managers, it's got
to
start with the top. But we're not the kind of firm that just throws a binder over and says, good luck
here,
with that.
You're on your own now.
That's why it takes, we're usually with clients for a couple of years because it does take
And it sounds
time.
Like you're kind of immersed there. You're not just, they don't probably see you as a vendor. You're more of a partner in this.
Well, they get sick of me, but my team is great. So, yes, my team members are, they end up being really a part of their firm, a part of their team, usually HR. So,
and what's the most rewarding part of the job for you?
I think building a business that's incredibly unique and getting a team of people that used to run talent acquisition, talent management, and finance for companies like Coke and Revlon and Best Buy and Home Depot to all work together in this group. And there's nothing out there like it.
Now, was it difficult for you and your own team to get them to not kind of be the person that's calling the worker, you know, the recruiter person? Because that seems like there's some, you know, you do that and then you get someone hired and then you're done. You get to check a box. Like, that's really rewarding for some people that you can do something and see it. You've accomplished something. Where this sounds some strategic and we're in for 3 years and we're making these incremental kind of changes that, you may not necessarily see anything improving today, but you know you did a good job.
I think helping a business build the value of that business is way more rewarding. Helping them make connections between business value, intellectual capital, and key talent is having them understand that link. And it's not just HR and let's take our HR resources and spread them as evenly as possible so you don't piss people off. That is a recipe for failure. We are out of the industrial economy. We are now in the knowledge economy. And there are scarce resources for the most critical jobs. So we have to throw our analog, old school, ineffective approach to recruiting out the window. And when senior leaders make those connections, it's pretty amazing. And it is going to determine what grows the value. It's all intellectual capital. It's all off the books. So it's nothing like they've dealt with in the past.
Now, if you were going to give a tip to one of these firms going through this, what would they be? What would be kind of your pro tip?
I would say have a very honest conversation among the senior leaders about how are we adding value in the future? How's our business growing? And what are the key functions and roles that will enable that? And shed yourself of the idea that everybody's equally important, that everybody has to be treated the same. Your business will go under trying to do that.
So you kind of, once you prioritize, just go strong after that, those yes. priorities and work your way down the list.
Yes. And it's not to say we're not going to fill restaurant manager jobs. We're going right. to fill those, but we're going to optimize it through technology. We're going to have a less, you know, manual approach to it. We're just going to drive efficiencies. We'll have more junior recruiters working on those jobs. So it's not like we're just going to walk away from
right,
them.
Right, you're
we're
not ignoring
them. Different process. Yeah.
And you're putting the more talented people on the more
yep.
talented people.
Yes, yeah.
So now, what are you reading? What's over there?
Oh, this is a great book I just picked up on the way. Actually, no. Yes, this is book Talent Valuation that was published just this past March by my partner Tom and I about this. He is a former CFO of Revlon and led finance all over the world for Coke, and then weirdly spent 10 years running talent acquisition at Coke too. So he has this very unique blend of HR and, talent, finance. So this is kind of the whole recipe for what we do within companies. And then my other kind of hobby is sort of not related. It's driving your own development, taking your career into your own hands. Don't wait for your boss or somebody else to tell you what you need to do to get better.
So now, do you think that today's employee has to kind of think more like an entrepreneur
Absolutely.
When it comes to their career?
Absolutely.
Because you don't want to be thought of as just a cog in the machine.
Yes. No.
Those days are over, right?
Well, the days are over of managers actually sitting down and thinking and being held accountable for driving your career. If you don't drive it, it's not going to happen.
That's a harsh reality for some people.
Does that sound harsh?
It's a little scary for some people.
Oh, it is. It is. But I think there's resources out there to help people.
And then you said the sweet spot for your business is Fortune 500 companies?
You know, we're growing in mid-cap. So I'd say it's for companies that are having a hard time staffing their critical roles.
And then if somebody wants to get a hold of you, where do they go?
Linda@designsontalent.com.
Good stuff. Well, thank you so much
thank
for being
you.
Part of the show today. Casey, you learned something there?
I learned a lot. That was great.
You weren't writing any notes. You figure you're going to walk out with one of those books? Is that what your plan was?
I don't know. She only has one copy. I thought that was yours.
I don't know. You didn't see her handing it to me. So, Casey Smith, you're with Wiser Wealth Management. Can you share a little bit about your organization?
Sure. We're a fiduciary, fee-only wealth management firm located in downtown Marietta, just north of the perimeter. Our clients are mostly individuals and small businesses that are looking for people to come and help them, give them advice on wealth management. Building assets. We also have a legal side and a tax side as well.
And you just won an award, right?
We did. Cobb Chamber awarded us one of the top 25 small businesses in Cobb County. That was a great honor. Cobb Chamber is a very good organization.
Yeah, there's more than 25 businesses there, so that's pretty impressive.
That's right. That's right.
So now, how do you go about doing your business? Fee only means that they only pay, there's a fixed fee? How's that work?
Yeah, you know, unfortunately, my industry is really confusing. There's two standards in our business. There's the fiduciary standard, and then there's a suitability standard.
You're using the word fiduciary like you think I know what that means.
Yeah, exactly. And that's
I need some help there. Can you help define some terms?
So the fiduciary simply means to act in your best interest. Your doctor has a fiduciary duty to give you the best care, as well as your attorney.
Right.
Some people would say real estate agents have a fiduciary duty as well. In this case, in our industry, independent advisors such as us, you know, our clients don't actually have money at Wiser Wealth. We custody with TD Ameritrade, so their money's actually at TD Ameritrade. We're just their managers for those assets. But in our world, we have to give the best advice possible to those clients. The fee-only part comes in because we essentially are receiving no commissions. We're either getting paid by the hour, or we're getting paid as a percentage of assets under management. In my opinion, the product should never pay the advice giver.
Right.
And that creates a lot of conflicts for the client in the end. So we're regulated by the state of Georgia or various states that we're doing business in, or the SEC, we meaning independent advisors. If you look on the other side, you can go to any bank or brokerage house in the street corner, right? They're regulated by suitability. They're going to have you fill out a risk tolerance questionnaire and make sure the investment's suitable for you.
Right.
But the compensation that we get from each product could be totally different. So therefore, there's a huge conflict of interest. That's where most of the money is in wealth management space.
Is those commissions?
Is inside those trailing commissions. They try to look like us. They try to look like independents in that, yeah, we have a fee-based platform. But in the end, it's totally different. And unfortunately, people in our business who are trying to help us, like the CFP board or the CFP certification, they make it worse because they allow those advisors to also carry the CFP designation and claim right. fiduciary duty, but yet their employer says, oh no, there's no fiduciary here at all whatsoever.
Right.
Where some of us on the independent side also carry the CFP designation. The difference is if I don't work in the best interest of the client, I'm held accountable in a court of law. On the suitability side, if I don't sell something suitable to the client, I go to arbitration. These are two very different things.
Right. Now, in your case, it sounds like you're truly watching the back of your clients.
Right. We all sit on the same side of the table.
Right. Because you're not getting, your incentive is to grow their wealth.
Correct.
Right. That's where theoretically you're going to get paid more as opposed to if they buy a certain investment.
Correct. I have an example. I have a friend of mine through church that works at a large brokerage company. We had taken some clients to the tour championship a few years ago and I had 6 tickets left over and I sent him these 6 tickets. I said, hey, maybe you could use these for some of your clients.
Right.
He couldn't think of one client that liked golf. He had 3,000 clients that he was responsible for. But once you sell the product to the person,
you can't
really sell them anything else. And so there's no relationship that's developed.
Right.
I don't need a risk tolerance questionnaire or a form to know what my client's hobbies are. I just know
that Mary likes golf.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. Yeah. Because she talks about it or we've been golfing. Right. So it's a totally different world.
It sounds more personal.
It is. When we have 162 clients, which doesn't seem exceptionally large, but it's the right size.
Right.
We can efficiently grow that to probably 300 clients and keep the same size, and then eventually start adding junior advisors, right? As our company gets larger, all under the same fiduciary fee-only concept.
Now, how did you get into this? Were you always working
no,
in this
I started
manner?
Off. I started off on the dark side of the world. I started off at a large company downtown, and I always say I grew up in a bubble. Right, I'm a local guy, right? So I grew up in Marietta. I went to Berry College up in Rome, Georgia. I got my finance degree. We call it the Berry bubble, right? So I come out of the Berry bubble, and I come down to Atlanta, and I'm like, what stuff really happens? Are you kidding me? And who's your first victims when you come out of school, right? It's your friends and family.
Right?
They don't ask your GPA or how you did in that portfolios class. They want to know 100 people. Give me 100 people that you know, and that's what you're judged by. You know, that's for marketing, and it's probably good to know that you know some people in town, I guess, but it shouldn't be the primary driver behind bringing people.
So now how do you get your clients? Because I would imagine this is a tricky sale because people are so weird about money. Except Linda's, she's probably not because she's got this figured out.
Right. 99% of our clients come through, I'll say that, 90% of our clients come through referral.
From other clients?
From other clients. Other 10%.
So who was that first
Google
client?
Based.
That was your friends and family?
So, yeah, friends and family. Well, the ones I took out of the brokerage house were the first clients. I guess I have a little unique career path. I've always loved aviation. And so when I left, I had to lay low for a year being a, you know, still a relatively young guy. And I went out and got, I didn't want to fight their attorneys or anything over
non-compete
kind of stuff.
Right.
And so I got my pilot's license and ended up, long story short, falling in love with aviation and ended up flying for a local airline here called Atlantic Southeast Airlines, which became ExpressJet. And I was a captain for them for about 5 years, first officer for 5 years before that. And I hung up my wings in 2014. Mm-hmm. Because I couldn't do both. We have 3 small children at home.
Right.
I needed to be a dad. That was more important. But I still do some things in aviation. Still have a lot of friends. A lot of our clients naturally come from the aviation world as our class that came through during the tremendous growth time for Delta and for Atlantic Southeast. Our clients are now at all the major airlines across the country. So we have some programs that we cater to them as well.
So now when you're dealing with having that first conversation, can you walk us through like what an onboarding of a new client looks like?
Sure. So generally they sit down and they have a lot of questions. And what they hear out of us is almost polar opposite of what they hear from other places. For instance, the biggest thing is, do you need your house paid off? And it depends on who you're talking to, right? If you're talking to a person with $20 million, a lot of it being liquid, okay, maybe you could use some leverage there and you keep some of that in maybe not the market, but maybe a private equity investment or something or their own business. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people that come to us, they've done the Dave Ramsey thing, right? They've worked really hard.
They got the envelopes.
They're done with that. They did that well, right? Right. In fact, they did it before Dave Ramsey. They just knew that don't spend more than you make, right? And save your money. So they get to retirement. They've amassed maybe $2-3 million, and then they go, I still got this $200,000 left in my mortgage. And most advisors tell them, oh, sell it because I can make you more money in the market versus paying off the house. And we were polar opposite of that. We think there's a peace of mind knowing that your house is paid off, no matter what happens in the marketplace. We tell our young people, who are growing with us, or we're growing with them, I should say, hey, let's make sure this is paid off by 65. And they're not used to that. They're used to, we lose assets, right? We think of about $3.5 million flowed out in January for retirees hitting that 59 mark. We try to get assets paid off, debt eliminated completely as they go into retirement. It's better for cash flow if you don't have the $1,500, $2,000 mortgage, right? And also I can guarantee you that you have a 3-point or a 4-point or a 5-point or percent rate of return.
Right?
Because you pay off that 3.75% house.
And that interest payment goes away.
Yeah. And if you compare it to market performance, the last 12 months,
you're winning.
You made money, right? So it's, and what happens with that is people go, oh, really? Wow. And that's how the client referrals come in. You just work in the best interest of the client. From there, we talk about if they already have investments somewhere else, we obviously look at the portfolios. We make sure that their risk tolerance is lined up with what's happening in the portfolio. A lot of people come in feeling uncertain about the future. And
really?
their prior advisor doesn't return phone calls anymore or emails.
Well, especially if the market went down.
Exactly. Right? Yeah, exactly. So we talk about that. We talk about long-term. And then we talk about, you know, we're not investing in individual stocks. We're not doing mutual funds. We're using index funds. That's very different for a lot of people.
Is that what you typically recommend?
Typically, yes. We're in index funds. For our wealthy clients, we have two private equity funds. Mm-hmm. If I'm going to do active management, I'd rather have a say in the projects and try to get a higher rate of return that way.
But otherwise, it's probably best to
otherwise
we have low fees, right?
Correct. Our average portfolio cost is around 18 basis points or 0.18%. In trading, we try to keep trading to a minimum. If you think about it, every time you make a transaction, that's a transfer of wealth between your pocket and Wall Street. And obviously,
there's a fee, and
we need a healthy Wall Street, obviously, to make everything run. But at the same time, there's a lot of other people who are ignorant about the process. Let them pay for it. We don't need our clients paying for that.
And that's a sneaky thing that people don't realize. Those little fees and all those transactions eat into your return. And then that makes a difference between it going up and down sometimes.
There's a couple of things that happen. One is mutual funds are always making trades, right? So you're losing rate of return in the mutual funds. It's all reflected. It's not that they don't tell you about it, but it's all reflected in your rate of return. You have a lower rate of return because of the transactions. And then most people don't understand what they're paying. A lot of people tell me, they walk in and say, well, I'm not paying anything.
Right.
I don't pay anything for investment advice. It's all free. Because the guy told me that I don't pay him. And well, it comes out of the funds, and that's actually a big hurdle because they get their first statement from us.
Okay.
Yeah, that's right. They get the first statement from us and they go, well, what's this invoice in the back? I was like, well, that's our fee. And that's the average year expense ratio. And it's being reflected in an invoice, which you don't pay. It comes out of the account. And they go, well, I never paid this at the old firm.
This is ridiculous.
It's like, you're right. You never paid that. You paid three times that.
Right. They just hid it from you.
Exactly.
So transparency sounds like an important component of your practice as well.
Yeah, and it should be of any independent fiduciary firm. You know, it's very interesting. You know, I go and I I speak or I'm just visiting other groups, other trade groups. The independent guys, we're known as RIAs, Registered Investment Advisory Firms. We all stick together. We all help each other out. We've got four firms on speed dial. I can pick up the phone and go, hey, man, I'm having a hard time with this. And we all
kind of work together.
You don't see that on the other side. They're salespeople, right? So they're trying to sell more than the next guy.
Right.
Because
that's how they're incented.
Correct. That's right. That's how their compensation is built. Yes, obviously I want to grow my firm. That's better for everybody if Wiser is growing.
Right.
But certainly if I don't meet my goals, it doesn't hurt the individual client that's with us.
So now when you are growing, how much time do you give to each of your clients? Like, is this something that you see them once a year or you have a conversation or you just mail them something?
Initially it could be weekly because they're just getting to know us. And so they'll call, I have a question about this. Or what about this? Or maybe we need to go back and get a form signed because you know they want to make sure they see all their accounts in one login, something like that. But do you have
like a portal where they can go and kind of see everything?
Correct. Yeah, the technology in our industry is growing every day. I mean, if you don't like what's there, just blink.
Wait, no, something will be there tomorrow.
Every 3 months initially, and then it usually gets to the point where the client says, I don't really need to come in.
I kind of get this now.
And then it flips to where we have our legacy clients I bought a firm in 07, we merged them together. So the legacy clients, it's like pulling teeth to get them to come in once a year.
But you want them to come in.
Absolutely.
At least once a year, right?
Absolutely.
Because things change, you know, their goals might change or their circumstances might change.
One of the things that we do, our core of our business is while the client sees it as asset management, I look at it as financial planning, even if you're already retired. And so we're always doing scenarios where we apply our current portfolio we're using for them with their current expense rate, their future foreseen expenses that we know about, as well as a class that we don't know if you're going to need $50,000 tomorrow to do whatever, right?
Right.
So we try to keep on top of that with them. But then we look at the market and we come up with 10,000 different possibilities. And so we're always trying to get this percentage of success. We don't want our clients running out of money before age 95. That's always our goal. And of course, they always fight back.
So they're on their own at 96.
Yeah,
right?
At 96, they're all on their own. Yeah. Now we have a few that have longevity in their family. A lot of them go fight us on that and go, I'm not going to live past 80. My dad didn't live past 75. And we say, we have a cushion built in on two ways. One is your age. You statistically shouldn't live till age 95, but what if you do? And then there's a cushion built on the bottom for if they start running out of money, then you kind of go into that reserve the last few years. And the biggest thing, the hardest thing to plan for is healthcare costs. Healthcare costs are going up. Inflation is 6.5% a year right now for healthcare. And so we don't sell the policy. We partner with other firms to help facilitate the purchase of long-term care insurance. But you look at that and you go, man, you know, $3,000 a month. And that's if you just need a little help getting your clothes on in the morning.
Right.
If you have Alzheimer's, you're looking at $6,500 a month or more in some cases. How do you plan for that, right? And so we try to stay on top of that.
Now,
and that's what those annual meetings are about, is to make sure everything's moving in that direction.
Now, when you're going, working with a client, what's your sweet spot of age? Are they already retired or they could still be working?
So our average client right now is 58 years old, net worth about $1.5 million.
And so they're done working or they're...
Most of them are done working, yeah. We have our clients are all over. I mean, we have some clients that are executives that run very fast-paced growing companies, even in their 60s, right? And then we have some clients that literally are the guys that came out and fixed your power lines, right, in the middle of the storm, and they walk out with $1.5-2 million in pension and 401k assets that they've accumulated. And so our knowledge is very different,
right?
And, you know, working with an executive who probably has a little more business knowledge of working markets versus someone else who
has always worked for somebody else and all of a sudden they got a pile of money.
Exactly. So it's two different mindsets. Interesting that when a lot of those guys first started coming to us, they said, all right, I got this. It's supposed to double every 7 years, right?
Right.
And you're like, well,
put it in that doubling box.
You're like, well, you could take that risk or you could live a very comfortable lifestyle the rest of your life with very moderate risk.
Your call.
Right. So yeah. Love is just explaining it to him.
So now you don't typically work with a person who's working at a large firm and they have their own kind of the firm has their own 401k or whatever.
And we will. We'll do a lot of those, actually. But what we do is we charge by the hour. I think we all did this to some extent, but I call it when you hit your 30s, hopefully you've paid for the sins of your 20s
right.
by that point, right? And so if I could get a hold of 20-year-olds and tell them what I know now, if I'd done this at age 20 or 22.
Right.
So we have some of those come through. And honestly, we may charge $250 for a four-hour.
Like an annual kind of check-in to tune up their 401k to kind of reallocate the investments.
Take a look at the 401k plan, make sure they're on track. You know, just kind of keep them moving forward. We're in a situation where we are fiduciaries, so we can actually give advice under the ERISA laws, which 401ks fall under, mm-hmm. where if you walk into the bank or the brokerage company, technically they're really not supposed to be giving advice on 401k plans.
Well, good stuff, and congratulations on your award. That's a big deal.
Thank you.
And if somebody wanted to learn more and have a kind of a more informed conversation, where should they go?
Sure. You can go to wiserinvestor.com. It's WISERINVESTOR.com, or you can email me at KCCASEY@wiserinvestor.com.
Thank you so much for being part of the show today.
Thanks for having me.
All right. This is Lee Cantor for Alex Shiflett and our guests here today and all the Business Radio X family saying we will see you next time on Atlanta Business Radio.